My name is Michael Wise. I'm a partner in the Los Angeles office of Perkins Coie LLP. I've been with Perkins Coie since 2002. I'm an intellectual property lawyer, and my primary practice involves patents. I'm testifying from the Los Angeles office of Perkins Coie, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear by video conference. Here with me today is my counsel, Bob Gooding. He's to the right of me. In 2006, Mamtech International retained Perkins Coie to file and prosecute patent applications for the manufacture of sucralose, to evaluate issued United States patents related to sucralose, and to file and prosecute trademark applications. In addition, Mamtech US engaged Perkins Coie sometime after 2006. The general scope of the work done by Perkins Coie for Mamtech US was related to intellectual property and trademark work. In 2006, Perkins Coie prepared two patent applications for Mamtech International regarding the manufacture of sucralose. There were a total of four families of patents that we filed for Mamtech, which were all related to the manufacturing of sucralose. It's my understanding that these patents were owned by Mamtech International and licensed by Mamtech International to Mamtech US. I visited the Mamtech plant in Wuyishan, China, twice prior to the closing. Once in November of 2007, and a second time in November of 2009. During my 2007 visit, I visited the plant with two former Perkins Coie employees. One was my former partner, Zoe Wong, and the other, a technical advisor named Stephen Gu. The purpose of this visit in 2007 was, first, to see the facility. Second, to make sure that the disclosures of the patent applications that we had filed on behalf of Mamtech were consistent with what was occurring on the production line. And third, to confirm that the line actually existed. In 2007, I observed an 18-ton sucralose production line. I spent approximately an hour observing the production line, and then I spent more time touring the remainder of the facility. I observed the output of what appeared to be sucralose, but I did not test it chemically. I also observed what appeared to be a fair amount of finished sucralose product. My belief that the product was sucralose was based on the representations made by my client, Mamtech. During this visit, I confirmed that the plant equipment and the processes were consistent with disclosure of the patent applications we had filed on behalf of Mamtech. I also observed a tea manufacturing facility in a separate building of the plant. That same day at the plant, I was served tea sweetened with sucralose that I understood came from the Mamtech production line. During my 2009 visit, I visited the plant for approximately 2 days, again with my former partner, Zoe Wong. The purpose of this visit was first to make sure that the sucralose manufacturing process was consistent with the disclosure of the patent applications we had filed on behalf of Mamtech. And second, to collect documents that would allow the Mamtech owner investors to have a record of the process in case something happened to the facility in China. During that visit, I observed two production lines. Specifically, I observed the 18-ton production line I'd seen in the 2007 visit and a new larger 60-ton production line. I observed that the 60-ton production line was operating, but because it was a multi-day process, I did not observe the final product output. During this visit, Zoe Wong and I reviewed flowcharts, an operations manual that's also known as the cookbook, blueprints for assembling a sucralose production line, and equipment list. I also took photographs, videos, and notes. The photographs were primarily of the 60-ton production line. A Additionally, during this visit, a Manitech engineer and a Manitech representative verified that the 60-ton production line was constructed substantially in accordance with the blueprints that had been provided to me, and the processes used were substantially in accordance with the processes reflected in the patent applications filed by Perkins Coie for Manitech. I did note some deviations between the blueprints and my notes, but I did not have any reason to believe those deviations were significant. Following my 2009 visit, Manitech provided Perkins Coie with a sample of what I believed to be sucralose that originated from the Manitech plant. In 2009, I spoke with Tom Cunningham and Corey Mahaffey. In June of 2010, I spoke with Tom Cunningham and Corey Mahaffey by telephone about my visit to the Manitech plant and what I had observed during these visits. I would note that I did not conduct an independent evaluation of the production line, but relied on the representations made by my client, Manitech. In July 2010, I sent Tom Cunningham a letter summarizing my observations during my plant visits and the actions I took regarding the documents that were to be placed into an escrow account that was created in connection with the Manitech Moberly project. It's my understanding that the blueprints, the cookbook, copies of my notes and photographs, and the vendor equipment list were all placed in that escrow account. Thank you.
Thank you, and you've answered a few questions already. I sent your attorney, and I assume you have in front of you, two documents. I think you referenced both of them in your opening statement. One is an email with my legislative assistant, Amanda Littlefield's name on top. It's just our way of printing it, from Corey Mahaffey to some folks here in Missouri regarding conversations with you. And then the second one's this letter you referred that you sent to Tom Cunningham. I want to ask you first about your conversations with Corey Mahaffey. And I guess let me start this way. Was it one conversation or was it multiple conversations with one or with both of them?
I had one conversation with Corey Mahaffey during this process. I did meet him when I went to the opening ceremonies at the close of the process. But in terms of substance related to this transaction, it was one conversation with Corey Mahaffey. And then with Tom Cunningham, I had several other conversations that were related to some of the documentation that was going into the deal.
And that documentation is what you referred to already about patents and pictures of equipment that you saw yourself in China?
That's correct. It related to that and the other documentation related to the deal, that type of conversation, negotiations over what was going on.
Okay, and you went in 2007, and you said at that time you observed an 18-ton production line. At that time, how many employees did you witness at the plant?
I don't specifically recall. There were plenty of employees, and what I mean by that, it was my understanding there were a tea facility and a sucralose facility at this plant. And on the sucralose side, I observed several employees. And then on the tea facility, I saw several employees as well. So
at least a dozen, probably 20. I'm really not certain.
Okay. And when was that 18-ton production line large enough to service anything other than the tea facility?
I don't know.
You don't know. You're going to need to speak. For a moment, you were very clear, and then you've become unclear for a second. So whatever you were doing before in regards to audio, please do that again. There, that's better.
I think my document was on top of the mic that's closest to me.
Okay, well, let's clear the documents so we can make sure to hear. So then you went back in November 2009, correct? Okay. You saw a 60-ton production line in operation?
Yes.
And how many employees did you see at that point?
At that point, I still saw many employees.
And specifically when they were running the Sucralose
60-ton production line, there were at least six, would be my guess.
At least six employees. Did Bruce Cole go with you on these trips, or was it just you and your associates from your firm?
In 2007, Bruce Cole was at the facility when I arrived. In 2009, Bruce Cole arrived as I was leaving. My recollection is I met him in the airport as he was arriving and I was departing.
Okay. Did you ever talk to local officials in Wayuxian City, Fujian Province about the plant?
No.
I don't want to know the context of what you said because I know you're going to make an objection as to privilege, but did you speak with officials there? No. Okay. The email from Corey Mahaffey states that you were in possession of a, quote, cookbook and an actual tested sample.
See that.
Are you in possession of a cookbook, so to speak? Is that the patent application process?
No, that's something different. So the cookbook is an operations manual. And the patent application was filed early in 2006. I would characterize the patent application to be more of a, it has a process in it, but the process is an earlier stage process. And this is a process in the cookbook that evolved from the very early stage process to the 18-ton production line to the 60-ton production line. So the cookbook is not identical to the patent application, but it is consistent with the disclosure of the patent application. I guess the best way to characterize it is the cookbook is more detailed.
Okay. As far as the tested sample, I want to make sure I've got your testimony right. You drank tea there that they told you was made with sucralose from the line there. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And then they sent you a sample to your Los Angeles office while you weren't in China anymore and said this came from our facility, correct?
The only change I'd make in that statement is that it came to my Shanghai office, and from the Shanghai office came to my LA office.
Okay.
So from the client to the Shanghai office to LA.
Fair enough. And from your opening statement, I take it you didn't go back after November 2009 to that plant, or did you?
I did.
You did.
Not before closing.
I'm sorry. We didn't catch that.
I did go back after my 2009 trip, but not before the closing.
Okay. So when did you go back? And when you say closing, do you mean the closing of the bond offering? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. What approximately was that date that you went back?
August of 2010.
Okay, so you went back in August 2010. What did you see in August 2010?
The purpose of the visit was very much the same as the previous visits. We were trying to make sure that the disclosures of the patent application and the manufacturing line of the sucralose facility.
We're consistent.
And figure out if there have been any changes in the last year that would require additional patent protection. And what we observed was the 60-ton line had been modified to have a an additional tower set up as part of its process. And we considered filing additional intellectual property on that.
Okay, I'm gonna go back to that. Have you been there since August 2010?
No.
Did you? You might not have caught my question. Have you been there since August 2010? No. Okay. And this is important because we have. We have a document that purports to be from Liaoning City, Fujian Province, some sort of governmental entity there that states that the factory stopped manufacturing or never manufactured because of environmental concerns. And that document is dated December 2009. And so what you're saying is that when you went there in August 2010, that there was something in operation.
The line was not operating in August of 2010. The line was in the process of being modified.
Was the tea company still?
I'm sorry?
Was the tea company still making its product next door?
I didn't tour the tea facility. I just went straight to the sucralose building.
Okay, and so at the sucralose building, were there employees there working on, say, the 18-ton production line?
No.
No. So there were, in August 2010, they were making modifications to the 60-ton line, and there was no work being done on the 18-ton line and no output. Is that a fair statement?
I don't recall... production occurring in that building at that time. My focus was really on seeing what the difference between the 60-ton line in 2010 relative to 2009. So I didn't make an effort to verify
whether or not there was
sucralose being produced at that time.
How long were you there? How many days did you visit the facility?
In 2010, I was there for about a day.
Okay. And was Bruce Cole... Well, I know what you're going to say to this question, so I will scratch that question. Let me ask you about your letter to Tom Cunningham. The last paragraph has a disclaimer. Is that typical? Is that sort of a disclaimer typical?
Typical in my practice, I put a disclaimer in documentation that I believe may go to the other side in a deal. And the purpose for the disclaimer, quite frankly, is so that the other people on the other side of the deal know that I am Mantec's attorney and that if they're doing due diligence, they should be doing due diligence with their own patent lawyers and their own people and verifying the information independently.
I'm going to give somebody else a chance to ask questions right now. If Representative Ellinger, and if you hold on just a second, we're going to try to adjust the camera so that you can see him.
I'm going to go ahead. You can hear me, whether you can see me, and I think hearing me is probably is important. When you visited in the August visit that Representative Barnes queried you on, were there other products being made on different lines, or was it all the same product that you could see? I didn't hear any answer.
I'm sorry, I was I'm sorry, sir. I was waiting for you to finish your question because my
Oh, I'm okay. Let me just say it again. When you visited and observed the last time you were there, before the last time when you didn't see before everything was being broken down or had been finished, that you watched a product being made on a line. And what I'm wondering was, first of all, how many lines, production lines were there? How many different products were there? Or was it all devoted to the one product that you were led to believe was the sweetener?
Okay, I think the best way for me to answer, let me try and answer your question. In 2007, when I showed up, I toured pretty much the facility, most of the buildings. And if you will, to my left, if I'm just walking in the gate to the enclosed compound, to my left was a tea manufacturing facility, which, quite frankly, I don't remember how many lines there were.
They weren't really
characterized as a line. You know, there were different stages of manufacturing.
These were like tea bags? Or
to my right was a building that contained the first sucralose line.
Okay.
And that was the 18-ton line. When I showed up in 2009, I didn't go back and look to the left at the tea production facility. My focus was
on the new 60-ton line, which was in the same building as the 18-ton line. And if you look at the photos, some of the photos, you can see both of the lines. At that time, the 60-ton production line was brand new, and that was really my focus. And in 2007, because it was the first time I'd ever been there, and I got a tour of the facility, I noticed the sucralose and the various stages of the sucralose manufacture. And again, I noticed it in 2009 when I showed up, because my focus was again on the new production line.
Let me interrupt you right there if I can. Did it have a brand name on it, or were you simply told that this is the sucralose line? How did you know, in your opinion, that in fact was the product? For example, I could see it could have a little white packet, and it could have a brand name on it. Or there could be some other identification or identifying marker that would indicate to you, as a non-engineer, perhaps as a lawyer, not as a engineering expert or production expert, that indeed had a brand name on it that indicated that's what was being made. Could you tell the committee if you had that kind of certitude? I mean, I guess the only real certitude you could have had is you'd had a chemistry lab with you and you ran a test right there. I don't think we're looking for that. How did you identify that as being the product as opposed to someone just saying to you, that's the product? Was there anything that, such as a brand name, such as a packaging, or anything of the nature?
First of all, everything at the facility is in Chinese, so I don't read Chinese.
You were with someone who did, though, as I recall.
That's absolutely correct. But I never questioned my client's representation to me that they were making sucralose, because that's the nature of the relationship. I'm a patent attorney. I question them about the process because my goal is to make sure that we get the best intellectual property protection for the company. And if the process changes, we need to make sure that we file patents or we analyze whether or not intellectual property protection would be useful and valuable for the client based on those changes. But I, like you said, I didn't chemically test the product. I relied on the representations from the client that this, in fact, was the product.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Sylvie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, to inquire. Right in the. Okay. We're, I don't know if you can see me or not.
Before you start, I would remind the committee there is a slight delay on both ends. So after you ask a question, you can give a couple seconds on both ends.
Sure. So in August of 2010, you revisited this facility, and the facility was or was not producing product at that time?
I don't know if the facility was producing product in August of 2010 or had been shortly before I showed up. What I observed in 2010 was they were making a modification to the 60-ton production line.
Okay. We have a document that the chairman referenced that says that the line was shut down in December of 2009. Business Week reported 2 weeks ago in a January 5th article that it had been shut down in 2009. At what point did you become aware that the line was no longer producing?
I don't know. One way or the other. I don't know. I saw the line produce, the line of production in production in 2009, and when I showed up in 2010, it was being modified and not producing.
During the, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to, during the intervening 8 months, was it ever brought to your attention, or were you ever made aware of the fact that the line had been shut down by the government in Wuxian? You were not aware.
I was not aware that the government had shut down the line.
Were you aware on that there was not product being produced due to government intervention?
My recollection is that I really don't know about the government and shutting down the line or prohibiting production in the Wuyishan facility. I was not the lawyer doing the regulatory work. I'm the patent lawyer.
So in the intervening 8 months between December of 2009 and August of 2010 when you revisited, was there ever any indication whatsoever, or were you under the impression for that entire time that the line was functioning normally and producing product? Was anything ever brought to your attention?
My understanding was that the I don't know if the line was producing or not producing between and when it was producing or not producing.
Between the time I visited in 2009 and the time I visited in 2010.
Were you ever made aware of the environmental concerns of the government in China?
Yes. I knew about, what I knew about was that there was going to be a different facility. There were some environmental concerns in China that required the company was looking to move the 60-ton production line to a different facility. And I believe the 18-ton production line had been grandfathered in. And that's pretty much the extent of my knowledge.
So when you were made aware of the environmental issues in China, was that ever a consideration when looking for a site in the United States that it would be unable to meet the environmental regulations in the United States?
If I understand your question, you're asking me, was there ever a concern about the environmental issues in the U.S.?
Correct. Once you were... Oh, no. Do we have audio? Oh, there you are. Okay. Sorry, we had a crash on our screen here, but I see you're still there. Okay. So, do you have audio, sir? Can you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So I'll just proceed. So when you were made aware that there were environmental issues with the government in China, was that a consideration or ever an issue raised that there might be similar or greater environmental issues in the United States? Because my understanding would be that the United States EPA would regulate things a lot tighter than China. I mean, at least that's what we read and hear about. So if it's, for lack of a better word, too dirty of a process for China, did it ever cross anybody's mind that it was not going to be okay in the United States?
Yes, you know, and now as you asked me this question, I need to clarify. And the issue I'm clarifying is this. I wouldn't say it was environmental issues per se that I was aware of. This is what I was aware of. The facility, Wuyishan, where the facility is in what we would consider to be a national park here in the U.S. So the Wuyishan is a small town in China, and you know, by our standards, it's a good, you know, by our standard, when you go to China, it's a whole different animal. So for example, I live in Los Angeles, which is a town of several million, a city of several million people. In China, Los Angeles would be considered to be a small city. They have cities there that have 20, 30 million people, some of the largest cities in the world. Wuyishan is the smallest place I've ever been in China. It's extremely rural, and it's where a lot of tea is made. And it's considered to be the equivalent of a national park. And what I learned, or what my understanding was that the central government had decided that Wuyishan was a protected area, kind of like Yosemite, and as a result of that, they weren't allowing new factories or new lines to be allowed to produce anything in that area, and I assumed it was because of the national park-like status of the area.
So according to Businessweek, there is an industrial zone in Wuxian, so I think it would be reasonable to assume that there are factories producing things there. It's not like Yellowstone.
That's the difference between China and the United States.
But there are other factories producing food and beverage in that province, in that right. city, near the factory.
That's correct.
Okay.
My point is that the lack of regulation in China on both environmental and a whole host of other issues, you find factories in places that we would never consider having factories in the United States. And what I'm saying is my understanding at the time was that it was the central government that was saying that this particular area was a protected area, similar to, say, Yosemite.
But it was
any additional development there. I don't know if it's true or not.
But it was after the factory had been built. I mean, they didn't say you can't build a factory. They built the factory. In fact, I think the local province underwrote and the government funded the factory. And once the factory was built, for environmental reasons of the process that was occurring at the factory is my understanding of why it was shut down. So when were you made aware of the concerns that the Chinese government had about this process, given the fact that they underwrote the production of the factory in the first place?
I explained to you what I understood at the time, based upon the central government, which I interpreted to be kind of an environmental thing, in the sense of, you know, if we had a tire manufacturer in Yosemite, and we decided Yosemite was going to become a national park, we would probably tell the tire manufacturer they had to go. With respect to what you're asking me about with respect to the environmental concerns, I read that in Business Week as well.
So before January 5th of 2012, you were unaware of environmental concerns in the province? So then what is your understanding that they were making tweaks to the line for back in 2010 when you visited in August?
It was a cooling tower.
It was a cooling tower?
Yes.
So you were not aware of any environmental concerns in 2010 when you were there. It was only in 2012 that you found out about that.
Environmental concerns of the government?
The reason that the production ceased, or the facility ceased production, according to both the government document we have and the Business Week article 2 weeks ago.
So that information, I've told you everything I know and I recollect from that time, and I thought it was a central government as opposed to a local government issue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Really quickly, if you can hear me, we're going to go to Representative Solon in a second. This is Representative Barnes again. I want to ask the question again. At what point precisely were you made aware of environmental concerns in China, whether that be from the local government or central government? At what period in time were you made aware of the environmental concerns?
Again, my understanding of environmental concerns was more related to my understanding that the central government had decided that they didn't want any additional factories built in this area. And I assumed it was, in my understanding, it was based upon this special area in China.
Wuyishan, the beautiful area,
has these wonderful mountains and rivers, and it's, to an American, it seems quite strange to see any kind of industrial zone in this small city, small town in China. It's very rural.
I could take you to a lot of places in Missouri where we wouldn't be surprised, but let me rephrase, because I understand you have a problem with my phrasing of environmental concern. So let me rephrase. At what point were you made aware of concerns of Chinese government about MamTech's China facility, whether they be for cultural reasons, environmental reasons, we don't like you, you didn't pay us enough money reasons? At what point were you made aware of concerns of the Chinese government, however you want to characterize those concerns?
Sure. It was between the 2009 trip and the 2010 trip. You know, sometime between 2009 and, you know, the close, I became aware of this special protected status from the central government that I understood for the area.
Okay, I'm going to let Representative Solon ask some questions, and we're going to adjust the camera once again.
To inquire, Mr. Chairman?
Go right ahead.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Wise. I was just going to ask some follow-up questions to Representative Barnes's questions. When you had visited the facility in 2007, it was an 18-ton line, and you observed, and I know you were just trying to remember, about 12 employees. When you went back in 2009, we had the 18 line and ton line, and also the 60 ton line now. But this time you only observed 6 employees. Did you ever ask the question of how many employees does it take to run these lines? And did it seem odd to you to see 6 employees operating an 18 ton and a 16 ton line? Or did that seem normal to you?
Well, it didn't seem odd. And I should probably explain a little bit more about the difference between the two trips. Remember,
in the first trip, I also went over to the tea facility and I saw a bunch of employees there. So when I'm trying to ballpark the number of people that I saw
on the first trip, I was including people I saw on the tea side in addition to the sucralose side,
or the overall number of people at the facility. Second trip, I just went to the sucralose side of the facility,
and I remember seeing six people, at least six, there might have been eight, but under a dozen. I wasn't counting the number of employees. And when I think about, you know, what appeared to be required to run the line, it didn't seem to be a labor-intensive process. Like, for example, you know, making a some kind of a device might be more labor-intensive than running the line, because it's pretty automated. And I didn't get the sense that you needed a lot of employees for it. But I'm not a I'm a patent lawyer, and I'm not a production engineer, so it would be difficult for me to really formulate an opinion on that.
Did you walk around the offices? Did you see employees in the offices? I guess what I'm getting at, does this seem like a vital, exciting production company with a lot of activity going on? Did you tour the offices? Did you see a lot of activity and employees back in the office section?
In both
instances,
you know, I'd say all three trips, when I went to the offices, I went to
a particular office. I saw a few people.
But it wasn't unusual in the sense that a lot of Chinese companies tend to be overbuilt. So in a lot of Chinese facilities, they have way more space than you need. So you wind up not seeing as many people as might be there. So I really don't have an ability to gauge the number of people that were on site.
And I'm just, my final follow-up is, I know that for the facility that was being proposed in Moberly, it was 161 people. So I guess probably, like you, this isn't my expertise, but I would have probably figured I would see about 161 people in the offices and walking around. And at any point in time, did you ask the question, how many employees do you have on staff? How many shifts do you have? How many people do you have working here?
No, I did not. That was not the focus of my, of what I was doing.
Okay. Thank you very much.
To inquire.
Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Wise. Representative Thomas Long. I want to concentrate on just for a moment, I hope. A lot of testimony has been given as to what Moberly could have done, could not have done to help them out. And there was some testimony, I don't remember from which law firm, that said that indeed they thought Moberly had done quite a bit of due diligence. Now, when you spoke of this disclosure at the bottom of your report, and that disclosure, as I remember, is to kind of throw up a flag and say, hey, I'm sending you something, but I don't work for you. I work for MamTech. Correct? Is that, you know, a fair non-lawyer interpretation?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, let's just assume that Moberly had picked up on that, and they go hire their own patent attorney. Okay. From the description that I have of the process that you're going through, is you're relying on the representations of your client and comparing the cookbook and the diagrams to the patented processes. Okay. What would their, if they were to go out and hire completely their own, suppose maybe a competitive patent attorney, what would they be relying on?
They'd be relying on their patent attorney to take a look at the documentation I have and the patents that we filed and make their own assessment as to what they were getting. And quite frankly, you might want to go visit the facility. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the person on the other side of the table would want to go visit the facility themselves and interview the people there.
But if they were relying on the work that you had done, and you were relying on the representations of your client, they are effectively just working off the representations of MAMTEC, correct? As presented by your client by yourself under patent law.
When we do due diligences for our clients, you know, on the other side of the table, if you will, there's several things that we do. We would first start off and make sure that we have a clear chain of title to all the intellectual property owned by the company. Second, we would do what's called a landscape assessment and freedom to operate assessment. In other words, we would want to make sure that we were certain that the company had the ability to operate in the various markets that they wanted to operate on without significant risk of being shut down by someone who had a patent that might be infringed. Third, we'd take a look at where the company's intellectual property fell within that landscape and what type of competitive barriers to entry to market those patents would be. Fourth, we would then want to make sure that those patents that were filed were reflective of what the process was that was being done. And of course, having a clear understanding of what the process was would be necessary to determine whether or not there was freedom to operate in the patent landscape that existed at the time. So those are the things that we typically do in due diligence when we're on the other side of the deal.
And let me share with you a little bit why I'm asking this line of questioning. You know, one of the things that is coming out of this is, you know, who's responsible and who could have stood up and said, hey, this is not a good deal. Who could have protected Moberly? Who could have protected the bondholders? One of the ideas has been, you know, bandied about, which is mandatory insurance and getting somebody else to make sure that they're looking at the bondholder. And what I'm trying to get at is if put yourself on the side of Moberly, now you're relying on another patent attorney. Somebody hires you to back up on their patent. How does a Moberly really actually protect itself when it's dealing with this intellectual property issue? Is there really a really good strong way? And I'm not suggesting that you've done anything wrong. I want to make that clear. I'm looking for a solution to where, you know, we can move forward once this is all said and done.
I understand your question. And you know, mind you, I'm a patent lawyer, so I have a limited experience relative to deals.
You know, I work on deals, but I work on my small piece. There are people who do this for a living. For example, venture capitalists do deals for a living. And, you know, my understanding is that part of this process is, you know, some companies make it and some companies don't. And that's a risk that venture capitalists are willing to take when they put their money in. And when they put their money in, you know, they also get a bit of control over the company so they can have some control over things. And the difficulty here is, you know, government in the U.S., we have a system where government and business are not intermingled.
In China, it's a completely different animal. You're almost hard-pressed to find companies in China that don't have some kind of a government intermingling.
It's a very different system.
So, you know, I think, you know, from the perspective of trying to figure out, you know, how you can avoid
these kind of
situations in the future, what I suggest you do is talk to
business people that do a lot of these deals and get a sense
of, you know, what are the safeguards and what are the things that they do to ensure that these things don't go south.
Do you think, as a patent attorney, what's your opinion of China's respective IP property to start with?
Come a long way.
The
I first started going to China in 2002. And at that time, the country, I would say, was more focused on being the world's manufacturer than being an innovative company. Since that time, China has become focused on becoming an innovator and switching their economy from being kind of a me too, but a true innovation economy. And the government's put a lot of money into this. So, you know, China's progressing. It is not the U.S. It is not Europe. It's not Japan in terms of the level of intellectual property protection that you have and the respect for intellectual property.
It's a developing, it's an industrialized country that's developing. You've got a massive
migration of millions of people from the country into these cities. Something, you know, that happened in the United States, you know, 100 years ago, we industrialized. And, you know, people are coming from the country and they're very entrepreneurial, they're setting up companies, and some people don't even understand what intellectual property law is, because it was only 20 years ago that people didn't own real property, and it was, maybe it was 25 years ago. Kind of goes to show how long I've been there, but it wasn't that long ago that China was a communist country and people didn't even own real property. So intellectual property relative to real property is a relatively amorphous kind of concept. So for a country that has had patent laws for since 1985, China is doing a tremendous job in terms of improving. Is there counterfeit things going on in China? Absolutely. Is it greater than the U.S.? Yes. Is there counterfeit here? Yes. Do people infringe patents in China? Yes. Do they infringe it in the U.S.? Yes. Do they infringe them more in China? I think so. The problem with enforcement in China is damages are low relative to the U.S., so if you don't have as much of a deterrent, you can't get injunctive relief. It's a much more difficult place to enforce intellectual property than the U.S. What do I think of it? I go there a lot. I have a lot of my practice based in China. I think it's the future. I think the future of a lot of the world market and a lot of the legal market is going to be in China. And I think it's just a matter of time before their intellectual property laws are akin to the U.S. and Europe. And that's because the locals are going to complain that they're not getting sufficient bite in their patents when they try to enforce them, and that'll drive the change.
Earlier you mentioned an escrow account that would have this cookbook and things like that. Do you know if that escrow account still exists, that cookbook is still around or anything like that?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. The audio was cutting in and out. Could you repeat the question, please?
Earlier in your statement, I caught on to, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's an escrow account that has this cookbook and this patent. Does this escrow account still exist to your knowledge? Does the cookbook still exist to your knowledge?
I don't know if the escrow account still exists.
And that, I believe, would be
somewhere near Moberly.
It would be in Missouri.
Because that's where the documentation was going. Copies of the cookbook still exist, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Parkinson.
To inquire, Mr. Chairman.
Go right ahead, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Weiser. I guess in your neck of the woods, it's still good morning. Just a really quick question. I know that you're a patent attorney. This may be beyond your expertise in dealing with the manufacturer of sucralose. Are there any environmentally problematic compounds or chemicals that are actually created as a byproduct of the manufacturing process when sucralose is manufactured? Or does the Chinese government, under the guise of this being an environmental issue, did they have legitimate concerns?
I don't know. I don't have sufficient knowledge of either the U.S. or the Chinese environmental regulatory regimes to be able to comment on that.
Well, in doing business in this particular province, which you equate to a national park in this manufacturer being shut down by the central government. Are you aware of any other similar situations in this particular province that the central government of China has shut down under similar circumstances, claiming the environmental issues?
This is the only, this is the only plant I had in Wuyishan. And I'm not certain if I had other clients in this province. But the difference between China and the U.S. is, quite frankly, you know, our political structure, and the government can pretty much shut down what it wants to in China when it wants to. So I don't have a specific instance to compare this to, but it wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, it's just to pacify my own curiosity on whether this particular plant was shut down, or they shut down all manufacturing facilities to try to clean up, if you will, this park type province.
I understand your question, and my comments about the central government, the kind of national park status, that's all I know. Okay. And I didn't tour the industrial area to see if additional facilities have been closed. My understanding was they were basically, as opposed to shutting everything down, they just didn't want any growth. What you had there was okay, but you couldn't add any more. And my understanding was, and that's my understanding.
Okay, thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Representative Kelly, are you? You may hold on just a moment for some camera work.
I guess I have to. Counselor, my lawyer, my daughter's a patent attorney, but other than that, she's a nice person. Do you know when production stopped in China? Do you know that it did stop ever?
I don't know when it was running and when it wasn't running. So it's difficult for me to answer that question. I wasn't maintaining, my finger on the pulse of the company relative to
which lines were running when, and
why they were or were not running.
You know if it's running now?
No idea.
Okay. Who do you actually represent?
Sorry?
Who do you actually represent? Who's your client?
MAMTEC.
And what is MAMTEC? Is it a corporation? Is it a limited partnership? What is it?
Quite frankly, I'm a patent lawyer, and I did not investigate the corporate entities. And I'd have to go back and look at the engagement letters.
Do you represent Bruce Cole?
Not as an individual.
Only as a whatever of this entity that we don't know what it is.
Correct. I assume it's a corporation, but I don't know that as a fact.
So you don't have any representational responsibility to Bruce Cole?
Not as an individual. That's correct.
And you're currently representing MAMTEC, which we're going to assume for the purposes of the discussion is a corporation.
Presently, MAMTEC is not a client.
MAMTEC is a former client. Okay.
That's correct.
Did MAMTEC pay you for your representation?
Yes.
Did they pay you from proceeds of the bond sale?
I don't know.
When did they pay you?
They paid me in 2006.
Okay, clearly not from proceeds of bond sale?
Yeah. I got multiple payments over the years. So
it's difficult for me to, you know,
I'd have to go and check a lot of accounting documentation. The checks don't come to me personally. Perkins Coie is a
fairly large law firm.
Right.
So we have an accounting department where the checks go to. So I personally don't see that.
But it's still your obligation to know. So you don't know if you got paid from any of the proceeds of the bond issue?
That's correct.
Is there a document limiting your representation of MAMTEC?
I'm not aware of one.
So you represent them generally?
Oh, I understand. Is your question, what's the subject matter of my representation?
Yeah, I want to. The starting point is that your representation is general and complete, unless limited, right?
Well, I think you're also kind of. I think you're getting beyond my expertise as a patent lawyer into scope of representation, attorney-client privilege information. So,
well, I didn't ask you anything that's privileged yet. I asked you if your representation was limited.
I don't know how to answer that question, but I can tell you what my representation was directed to. I was
the intellectual property lawyer for MAMTEC.
Mm-hmm.
I did patent work, patent applications filing, FTO analysis, trademark work, all the intellectual property aspects, trade secrets, that all fell within my representation of MAMTEC.
Did your representation include anything to do with the financial aspects of the sale of the bonds? I'm sorry?
No.
Okay. Has your representation included anything to do with the use or distribution or sequestering or handling of any of the money from the bond sale?
No.
When did your representation of MAMTEC cease?
Towards the end of last year, I can't recall a particular date. My best estimate, and I could be more certain if I were to go pull some documentation, would be in October.
Okay. After the sale of the bonds.
Oh, yes. Well after the sale of the bonds.
All right.
Well, actually, I would say well after the close. I don't know when the bonds were sold.
Did your representation at any point involve any matters other than the intellectual property issues?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Fuhrer, and again, we're going to move the mic.
To inquire, Mr. Chairman.
The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Wise. Could you let me know when you first started representing MAMTEC?
2006.
I'm sorry, 2006?
Correct.
Okay. And when you visited them in 2007, was the line in operation at that point?
Was the line in operation at that point?
Were they producing product at that point?
I did see product at that point, yes.
Was the line producing it there at that facility?
It appeared to be.
Okay. When you visited in 2009, again, the line was in operation and they appeared to be producing product?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear a response. Yes, it was. Okay. Can you tell me what sort of warehousing facility they had at that plant?
They had a clean room. They had a, there was I didn't see a warehousing facility per se. The building that the line is in is quite large. So for example, when I went in 2007 and saw the 18-ton production line, I'd say the building was relatively empty. When they built the 60-ton line, it took more of the building, but there was still plenty of space. And there was a specific clean room, what I call it, where they were making finished sucralose product. But I don't recall seeing a separate warehouse per se.
What other patents does MamTech hold? Where else other than China?
Oh, many different countries. Patent applications were filed. I can't remember them off the top of my head. I'm sure Europe's in there. Pretty certain Japan. I would imagine Korea. So patents were filed worldwide, but the collection of countries, I'd have to go look that up for you. But I would say 10 to 12 different countries outside the U.S. Would be my best estimate as I sit here today.
Okay. And you represented MamTech in each of those applications?
Yeah, yes. The way that process works is we are their U.S. attorney, and we have relationships with patent attorneys throughout the world. So, for example, if you were to hire us to file a patent application and say, I want to file that patent application worldwide, we would contact other patent attorneys in other nations and send them our application for them to file in those nation states, and they'd charge us, and we'd pass the charges on to you.
So being familiar with their patents, obviously you're familiar with their cookbook, if you will, for how they produce it. You're obviously familiar with how they would warehouse it. Where would they store it after it was produced?
Well, the warehousing piece is not something I would really be familiar with, because my my focus is really, you know, starting material to finished product in terms of my analysis relative to patents. Where it gets warehoused at that point is finished product. It's really not that relevant. So that's why
I don't know about the warehouse.
When the finished product came off the line, how would it be packaged?
Well, my understanding was that the product that was being produced
at the facility was used to sweeten the tea.
So I'm not quite sure how they packaged it to get it over to the other side of the facility.
Were they distributing this to any place other than the tea plant next door?
I don't know.
Have they ever distributed it to any other plant other than the tea plant next door?
I don't know.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear a response.
I don't know.
So with all the other patents that you obtained for them, to the best of your knowledge, this plant only produced enough to ship to the tea plant right next door?
All I know in terms of sucralose that was used was that it was used for the tea company. I don't know if it was used anywhere else.
Did any of those other patents ever develop into a separate production facility?
It's the way I would characterize patents is that patents reflect products. So, and maybe there's a little bit future products. Like if I were thinking of a completely new way of making sucralose, I might file a patent on that, and that might be something different. I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
Well, it's my understanding, and I apologize if I'm not a patent attorney, and I'm not. It's my understanding that you've represented them in obtaining a number of patents in a number of locations in a number of countries. As such, you visited the line on several occasions, at least in 2007, 2009, and 2010. You followed the line. It would seem to me that it would be important as part of that patent development, production, shipping, distribution, to make sure that you understood what the process is so that when you came to the United States or any other location to get an additional patent, that that could all be included in the information that was provided to the patent office here. And we could tell whether or not the production, how it would be shipped, where it would go. And so I'm trying to get a little background for what it is that you observed and what was actually being done at that particular plant on those visits.
I understand, and I think maybe it'd be helpful for me to articulate a little bit about what my focus is, because unless the packaging and the distribution are something novel that's never been done before, a patent attorney is not interested in that, because your interest is in making sure that things that have that are protectable under patent law are protected. So if there's a new process for making sucralose or a change in a step in the process of making sucralose, that's what I'm interested in. And that's my focus. So, so I'm interested in learning about the process of how you make sucralose. And I'm not particularly focused on how much sucralose you make, how you bag it, and where you ship it.
Well, and answer my questions. How do you bag it and where do you ship it? That's part of your focus, you just said. So would you?
I there must be a problem with the audio, because that's not a part of my, that's not my focus.
Okay. So your focus stops at the end of the line where they get done producing it, before they bag it, before they ship it, before they store it.
That's right.
And when you toured those lines in 2007 and 2009, you didn't observe any sort of that activity?
No, I didn't.
Any other patents that you've done when you visited plants that produce other patents that you have you not observed the way that would ultimately be packaged, how it would be distributed, how it would be maintained?
The only time I would look at, packaging and shipping is for patents is if there was something novel about it. So, for example, if you had a really unique different type of a package that we could get a design patent on, maybe. And the shipping aspect, we really never even look at that unless you had some kind of a, almost a business method patent on a means of distribution. So really, particularly when it comes to chemistry, chemical processes, we're just interested in the chemistry and how the thing's made. So we wouldn't really have any focus on the product after it comes out of the line.
What changed in that chemical process between 2007 and 2009 that caused you to visit a second time?
Oh, it wasn't necessarily that there was a change, but what patent attorneys are always trying to do is to keep up with the client. So, for example, in 2006, we filed a patent application. And that's based upon a certain process that's in existence at that time. It could be a product, for example. And as the company comes closer and closer to commercialization, you want to make sure you're in contact with the client and what's going on to make sure that the patent that you filed in 2006 is going to cover what the product is that's going to come to market. So the purpose of the visit is not because there was a change that I was coming to observe, but it was more to make sure that if there were any changes, that those changes did not make my patents irrelevant and my patents wouldn't cover what the process was the company was pursuing.
So in order to make sure that there were no changes, you kind of watched each step of the manufacturing process to make sure that they were the same and consistent with what the patent allowed?
That's very close to what I would say. And what I would say is I interviewed the engineer and the inventor about each step of the process to make sure it was consistent with the application that we filed in 2006.
But again, you never followed the process from start to completion to packaging and be ready for shipment.
No. As a matter of fact, the interview pretty much, the interviewing process pretty much ended when we got to the point that, you know, the reaction was complete and the sucralose was made. That's the focus.
So I guess it's fair to say that you never really observed the production of this. You just interviewed the engineer about how it was to be produced?
I saw the machine working, but a lot of this, you know, is you've got a line of reaction tanks, and you've got chemicals coming into the reaction tanks mixing and various reactions going forward. So I don't think anybody could truly observe it because it's in the, you know, it's close to the eye. You know, these are not transparent tanks. So by nature, to understand the process, you're required to interview and get the information from the engineers. And I did not ever stay at the facility long enough to watch the sugar go in one end and the sucralose come out the other.
Do you know how long that process takes from beginning to end to produce it?
My recollection was that at the time it was about 4 days.
I'm sorry?
My recollection at that time was about 4 days.
4 days from beginning to end?
Yes.
And do you have any idea how much was being produced by that plant at your 2009 visit?
No.
I'm sorry, I think I lost connections. Was that a no?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, I don't know. Yes, you're correct. It's a no.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Oxford. Go ahead. Hold on. Let us move the camera first.
Hello, Mr. Wise. When you say a 16-ton line, what does that mean?
I believe I said an 18-ton line.
I'm sorry, 18.
That, I believe, again, this is something I learned from the client, is the annual production for that line.
They produced 18 pounds of product, 18 tons of product in a year.
I think it would be more correct to say the plant had that line had the capability of making 18 tons of product in a year.
Okay, so that would be the possibility for how much they could produce, but there might be reasons that they didn't gear up and do that much.
That's correct, and quite frankly, I don't know if that number is based upon, for example, running the line 24/7, or if it's, you know, weekends off. I don't know.
Okay. This MAMTEC matter is not the only one that this committee has looked at, and in one of the other issues that we've looked at, we were anxious to talk about lessons learned. Is there anything you would recommend to municipalities in Missouri and the Department of Economic Development here as something to note in our lessons learned column?
Boy, that's a hard question to answer.
I know that questions like that are very hard for attorneys to answer, but I'm hoping you might.
Well, the reason I say that is, you know, I have a very limited role in this deal. You know, I'm the patent lawyer, and I wasn't really involved that much in what the deal terms were. I don't even know what the deal terms were other than what I've read in the paper, and I assume I probably knew what the total amount at the time was. And I'm not very familiar.
I'm not familiar at all with municipality funding and bonds.
I mean, the
deals that I work on are venture
capital deals, generally, almost exclusively. Some of them are, are angel funding. And so the only
thing I can tell you in terms of lessons learned and things to think about is what I said earlier, which is, you know, if you could get some good advice from experienced investors on what they do to reduce risk and, you know, kind of ensure their investments. That's what I would look to do. I'd talk to those types of people. And quite frankly, I have some knowledge of that, but I'm not sufficiently knowledgeable about that world to advise my clients. And when we get into those situations, I call up corporate attorneys that do deals every day with venture capitalists, and they can better advise clients on, you know, how those things, how those deals go. So that's where I'd go. I'd talk to maybe an equity investor, a venture capitalist investor, or an angel investor, people who take risk and invest as a job. Would help you be able to better assess risk of a particular deal and things you might do to better protect your investment.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure.
And Mr. Wise, we're going to come back to me, and I think that's it. I want to follow up on a couple things. You testified earlier that at some point you were made aware of the Chinese government's concerns with the China operation. And again, I don't want to characterize those concerns, just that you were made aware that the Chinese government had concerns. At what point were you aware that those concerns had led to the stopping of the manufacturing process in Huaiyushan City?
Again, my understanding of this was it wasn't specific to MamTech. It was more specific to the region.
Okay, well, then specific to the region, at what point were you made aware that these concerns about the region, which included MamTech, happened such that it was shutting down manufacturing operations in the region?
Again, my understanding is it was just not allowing you to expand your facility. Not that it shut it down.
Well, you stated earlier that the 18-ton or the 16-ton line was grandfathered, but that the 60-ton line was something different.
That's right.
That's right? Okay. So at what point were you made aware that items like the 60-ton manufacturing line were being shut down in Huaiyushan City by central government?
Between 2009 and 2010.
Okay, in that time period, say December two after you went in November 2009, right? That's correct. That's when you were there. Is November 2009? Okay, and so it was sometime after that, but before the closing of the bonds.
That's correct.
Okay. You, in answering questions of Representative Fuhrer, you talked about why you went back, which was that in your practice, you need to check back to make sure the product they're making actually fits the patent they filed. And so you do that as they get closer to commercialization. Did MamTech ever reach commercialization?
I don't know.
Why were you sent in November 2009?
Because they had developed the 60-ton line. And we wanted to make sure that we captured any new intellectual property between the development of the 18-ton to the 60-ton line.
But they still hadn't reached that point of commercialization.
I don't know.
Well, did you ask that question? Would that be a question that you ask?
What I don't know is what they were doing with with all their sucralose. So I understood that the 18-ton line was going to, the sucralose was being used for the tea facility. I don't know if, for example, excess sucralose was being sold on the commercial market. I don't know.
And you didn't ask. We've got a freeze up. Sorry, we froze up, and you didn't ask either.
No, I would say at that point they were nearing commercialization, but I don't believe that they were out on the market selling sucralose.
So they were nearing commercialization in November 2009?
Well, that was the point of the 60-ton line.
Okay. Mr. Wise, thank you for being here via video conference. I think that exhausts all our questions. I have to ask Representative Kander, the loquacious one, whether he wants to ask any questions today. Okay. He's going to pass. Thank you very much for your cooperation and testimony today. We appreciate it on the committee. And I do have to ask, can you email me your opening statement? Your attorney should have my email address for purposes of we're putting all everyone's opening statement into the record.
Certainly, but I have to admit that I ad-libbed a little bit, so you'll find that the typed version may not be exactly identical to what I said.
That's fine. As a former speechwriter, I understand as prepared. So thank you.
Thank you.
And
I hope it was helpful.